So, you've decided to do a PhD. Whether you're just applying a few months in or the dreaded thesis write-up is on the horizon, you'll probably be thinking about what to do next. There often seems to be a dichotomy in the post-PhD life. Do I stay in academia or do I take the leap into industry?
It seems that around 60% of PhD students end up in some kind of industry role. If you're erring on this side of the fence, you might be wondering, what are my options? Will my topics or skills be relevant? Is there a chance for collaboration? What even is industry?
In this mini-series, we speak to interviewees who might just have the answers to some of these questions.
In this second episode, Katie and I met with David Robertson, a lecturer at the University of Strathclyde, who's carved out his own path since finishing his PhD, which straddles both academic research and industry partnerships.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us. Could you tell us firstly, how did you come to start a PhD?
Hi, Katie. Thanks so much for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. I'm sure that the PhD's podcast and the work that you do more generally will be a great resource for those who are interested in doing a PhD and perhaps also those who are already at the early career stage as well. So thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today and thanks for the work that you're doing. In terms of how I got interested in doing a PhD, probably best to start there if I might. And I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Glasgow in psychology. And throughout that time in a degree, especially during the sort of third and fourth, the honours years, what we had were scientists who were presenting their own research within the topics that they were teaching us about. So it was fantastic to have a first-hand experience of the science that was being published and the very latest in psychological science from the very people that were doing it. So I thoroughly enjoyed those classes. And then the catalyst for me wanting to do a PhD was really I never had an interest in clinical psychology as such in terms of becoming a clinician in that sense. And the sort of PhD route was the one that initially took my attention. But the way that it came about in a more concrete way was I was doing a critical review as an assessment on the perceptual load theory, which had been developed by Professor Nellie Levy at the UCL Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience. And I was very fortunate because she was invited to give a seminar talk at our department. And when I was doing my review, I found a recent paper that offered a criticism of the theory or an alternative account. And I spoke to one of the professors in Glasgow at the end of a lecture. I said, it was Professor Paddy O'Donnell, who's quite well known, is now passed. I said, look, I found this alternative account. Would it be rude of me to ask Nelly during the seminar talk? And Paddy's response was, no, it's science, it's a blood sport. So I then thought, okay, well, that's obviously an appropriate thing to do. So I attended the seminar, and I'll be perfectly honest with you, Katie, I don't remember a bit of her talk. It took me the whole hour. I was rehearsing the question in my head. If you can imagine a fourth year undergraduate nervously waiting their turn to ask a question, then that was very much me. But I did get the opportunity to ask the question at the end, and Nelly was impressed with the depth and the content of the question. We got talking after the seminar, and through that we decided to apply for PhD funding together, and that's how I ended up at the UCL ICN doing my PhD. So a couple of points there. If you're currently an undergraduate, attend your departmental research seminars because you can see how professional researchers present, but also it's the opportunity to meet and network with those that you might end up working with in the future.
I think it's so important to go to those seminars, like you mentioned, and ask those questions, even though it might seem daunting at first, because research is always questioning and coming up with new solutions to things.
And I can't put too fine a point on it. You know, being able to ask that question, the response that I got, you know, ultimately led to my current career path and changed my life. So if you have a question, you're just as entitled, having done your undergraduate training, as anyone else to ask it. So have the confidence to do it.
Definitely. And now could you tell us about your PhD topic?
Okay, so my PhD was on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in adults, and more specifically the attentional component or the inattention component of that particular disorder. Much of the research in ADHD has been has focused on children with the disorder and perhaps up to adolescence. But at that point, because much of the hyperactive symptomology tends to ameliorate or decline, there's been a lack of focus on the inattention or the attentional processes that might just continue into adulthood. So one of the most important parts of my PhD was recruitment. How can I get ADHD individuals into to test them and so on? And one of the ways that I decided to do that was being in London. I was very kindly accepted to attend some ADHD support groups in different parts of the city. And from that, you develop relationships, you outline what type of research that you're interested in and why it's novel and why it's important. And then through those relationships, you're invited to other ADHD support groups, and then you meet a variety of clinicians and other researchers as well. So already, just by that simple step, you're starting to build up your network. I also decided on the sort of public engagement side, with an eye to recruitment, of setting up a lecture series, a public engagement lecture series on ADHD. And across 7 or 8 sessions, we managed to get a speaker in who was a specialist in ADHD to give a talk at UCL to the public and individuals with the disorder. And again, with a view to saying that, you know, if you're able to contribute to research, then that would be great. But if not, it stood alone as a public engagement initiative. And so by the end of my PhD, I had been working with the support groups, fellow researchers, but also clinicians. I know that you guys are at the KCL, so it was the Maudsley Hospital as well that I worked with Philip Asherson and Yona Kuntze. And so that was a sort of the networking and network building aspect of my PhD, which stood me in good stead when I was looking to use those skills as a postdoc.
In terms of your career structure since then, what has that looked like since finishing your PhD? Have you been able to use these networking skills that you developed during your PhD in the postdoc role?
Since finishing my PhD, my focus on a particular research field switched from attention, perceptual load, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder towards facial recognition. And I was very fortunate to get a postdoctoral studentship working under Professor Mike Burton. It was Mike's ERC grant. And managed to get a 3-4 year postdoctoral research fellowship working with Mike. And that was firstly at the University of Aberdeen, and then we moved to the University of York. So during that period, I was on the applied strand of that particular grant. So what really interested me and what was important was our use of facial recognition technology in wider society. So if we take the concept of familiar face recognition, the idea that we recognise our friends, family, colleagues and so on with ease, despite the fact that their facial appearance can change quite dramatically. One need only looks at their Facebook profile over the last 10 years to see how their facial appearance can change in terms of pose, lighting, the natural aging process, and a variety of other factors. So generally, the brain is pretty robust and pretty good at recognising people that we're familiar with, something we do with ease and often something that we don't even give a second thought to. However, we rely on face recognition in societal roles which are vital to person identification and security. So for example, at border control, you have a passport officer who's trying to match the passport photo on a traveller's document to the traveller's face. In policing in the criminal justice system, very often police are trying to match the face of an individual held in a custody suite to a poor quality CCTV image. Now, the key distinction there is those officers and those border officials will not be or are unlikely to be familiar with that person. And over the last 10 years, research from Mike Burton's lab and a variety of other colleagues across the research field, the UNSW group in Australia and colleagues in America as well, have started to publish work which has showed that while we are robust and excellent at familiar face recognition, when it comes to matching pairs of unfamiliar faces, this is actually a really challenging task and one that's highly prone to error, because we don't know how the facial appearance of somebody that we're unfamiliar with varies, and that's what can lead to fraud. So I focused on that particular strand of the grant. And one of the most important things of being an applied cognitive psychologist, which is what I now see myself as, is liaising with the various parts of society to ensure that the research we're doing is relevant and applicable to the problems that they're having in the real world. So one of the highlights of my postdoc, one of the things that I really enjoyed was organising a face recognition conference, an applied face recognition conference, or it was more like a small workshop at the University of York in 2015. And from that, we were able to get researchers who were working in this field. We were able to get individuals from the Home Office Centre for Applied Science and Technology, individuals from the UK Inspectorate of Borders, and individuals from various police forces across England and Scotland to come and listen to the latest research, but also to have the practitioners present the operational nature of face recognition in policing in particular. And that meant, firstly, we could get everyone around the same table. we had everyone was aware of the latest in the sort of research and the operational processes, and it developed not only a network, but a pathway for collaborative work going forward. So in terms of reaching out to PhD students who are perhaps working on industry or on similar applied research, I think one of the best things that you can do, if it's not been done or there isn't a pathway, is to organise your own conference or workshop. And your department or your funder, there should be some money there somewhere to support that type of thing.
That's really simple but really good advice. If there's nothing out there that you think that suits your interests, create it yourself. So we've talked about your career structure and how you're very much working in applied psychology now. And I think when we think of finishing a PhD, we tend to think in binary terms. So either you stay in academia or move into industry. And actually, you're a really good example of someone who's doing both. Was it always your plan to stay in academia and work in applied science in this way?
So it's a good question. And I guess during my PhD, I did have that taste for the applied nature of research. So what we were interested in were the positive aspects of ADHD and whether there might be certain sort of cognitive aspects that we could look at that might enhance attention and focused attention in those with the disorder. So even from the sort of early days of the research career, it was a case of how can we get this into society? Is there scope for it? Is there a need for it? And that really sort of became the main focus during the postdoc. So I think what really excited me about the postdoc was the applied nature. And as a scientist now, what really does excite me is the fact that when planning research studies, there is always a focus, given the applied nature of my work, of is this relevant to operational processes? Can we make X, Y, and Z better or improve, you know, something in society? So that's what does excite me as an applied cognitive psychologist. And I think that the reason, I mean, I was hugely fortunate to get the postdoc, but really that set me on the career path doing something that I really enjoy, which is ensuring that there is a good theoretical basis to the work, but that we always think of the changes or the improvements that such work could give to society.
That's a really important distinction. Academia is a really thorough way of doing research, but you don't always get to see those results. And so with this applied part, you do get to work with the organisations that would then apply that research. And so how far do you as an academic get to go along that journey with them to implementation?
Sure. So that's a good question. So in terms of working closely with industry, I'm not in the heart of that particular aspect. So you will get PhDs who are doing perhaps a PhD that's funded partly by the industry partner and partly by a research council. That's not the sort of the length of the work that I typically do. So to give you an example, we did do some work on individual differences in face recognition, and we were approached by a police service. This was when I was doing my postdoc, and we did help them to implement and have a go at that within their organisation. But in terms of the best that I can do at the moment is that by continuing with the networks of these individuals I can have, I can ensure that I'm running research studies that are relevant to them. And then what I found is one of the most successful routes is to write industry review papers or non-specialist review papers on the latest state of the art for these types of organisations. Now, to give you an example of that, I have a recent review, a couple of reviews over the last couple of years for the United States Department of Defense HIDAC journal. And what that does is within that sort of Department of Defense sort of infrastructure, by writing for that in-house journal in a non-specialist way, which is a good skill to learn in itself, that allows greater dissemination of the research within that applied sphere. And I've also done things for similar things for European agencies as well. So if there are people in a situation like myself, and their research is applied, and one of the important things is disseminating that to a wider audience, and particularly the practitioner industry audience, then one of the best pathways that I've found is being able to write industry non-specialist reviews for relevant organisations.
Do you have any tips for communicating your research in industry or applied settings? Is this different to communicating in academia? Is the language different? What's that been like for you?
That's a good question, Caroline. Thank you. So again, as I mentioned previously, one of the best pathways is to write the non-specialist reviews for these industry journals. But likewise, if you think about the conference aspect, it's much the same process as well. So you'll go to an academic conference and you'll present with a level of academic and scientific depth. But if you're going to an industry conference, and again, as PhD students, very often registration for those should be open to you. Sometimes they're free, but if they're not, again, as part of your development as a researcher, you would hope there'd be some money from either your department or conference travel from your funder to allow you to attend those. So first of all, it's understanding that you should be there. So if you're a PhD student doing something that's related to a particular industry, and that industry is having their major conference or a small workshop, first of all, look in to see what the conferences are for that particular industry and start attending. And have things like a business card, because when you attend an industry conference, you want to be able to have a business card. Sometimes I've found that if you staple your business card to a recent review paper that you've had, and if people would like to have that information, then that's something that you've got to hand. So as I say, in terms of the differences there between academic and industry conferences are much the way in terms of academic and non-specialist writing that I mentioned a moment ago. But the specific things I would say is you need to have the confidence and you need to be proactive enough to go and attend these things. You need to develop your networking skills and your interpersonal skills so that you feel confident walking up to somebody during the tea and coffee break to say, "Hi, I really enjoyed your presentation," or "Hi, I'm a researcher from Institution X, Y, and Z. Could I tell you a bit about my research? Here's my card," and then follow it up. So you have to have a plan. It's not enough just to attend. There has to be a purpose to the attendance and some follow-up from that. And likewise, at these industry conferences, I've found, particularly for sort of border agency work or personal identification stuff, very often they welcome talks from scientists, because often some of the talks are maybe just from practitioners, or they are from vendors who are trying to sell a new facial recognition system or something. So what I've found is that if you're to look at a particular conference, there would be no harm in contacting that organiser to say, "Look, as a researcher, I have research that's of relevance to this. Would you be able to fit me in either as a talk or a poster or something like that?" So it's just about having that proactive nature and that confidence to go and do these things, but with an end purpose to them.
Thank you. That's definitely very inspiring. It makes me want to go out to a load of conferences in person as soon as we're able to again. Moving on to talk about your experience with the university's research and knowledge exchange. This was something that we were really interested in and we hadn't really heard of before. Can you tell us a little about this and how it works?
Sure. So certainly these days, knowledge exchange and the dissemination of your research is one of the important and vital things that you should consider. Because when you think about it, you've put a lot of effort into this, you've developed a really good research question, and if it has societal benefits, then it's your responsibility to get it out there to a wider audience. Now, there's a couple of ways that you can do that, which are relatively straightforward. The first thing is working with your university communications team to create a press release. If you have a paper that's likely to be of interest to the general media or the science media, work with your communications team or your knowledge exchange team to develop a press release, which will come out the same day as the paper. And then you will have, hopefully you will have interest from journalists in the media who will contact you to ask for quotes and some follow-up information, which is a great way to get it out there. And it's also good for enhancing the likelihood that other people will read your paper and so on. One caveat to that is, if you can, as part of your PhD training, try and get some public engagement or some science communication training. I was very fortunate that my boss at the time, Mike Burton, was able to fund through the grant training in sort of media skills. I went to an excellent workshop at the Royal Society to do that. And I found that was really good, because you have to be professional. You have to ensure that any quotes you're given are based on the science. And you have to know as well what the boundaries are between the media and yourselves as well, whether things are off the record, on the record, or so on, if you're working in an area of research or industry that's controversial, for example. So press release is the first good way of doing it. But if you've not done it before, make sure that you're doing it with your supervisor in conjunction with your research and knowledge exchange team. I don't think any researcher will ever feel comfortable of just getting a phone call off the bat from a journalist. You always have to ensure that you're prepared and that you know what it is that you're going to say, and you can provide the information that's relevant to the study and the science without offering controversial opinions or anything like that. You are a scientist at the end of the day. The second thing I found to be hugely valuable is the platform known as The Conversation. The Conversation is a worldwide science communication platform, and I managed to persuade Strathclyde to become an institutional member of that again. Now, again, you what you would do if you knew your paper was coming out on date X, you would pitch a small paragraph to an editor of The Conversation. It's an online platform. And if they thought that that was an article that would be of interest to a wider range of readers, they would call you back. You'd then work up a 12 to 1500 word non-specialist accessible article on your research, why it's important, why it's relevant, working with that journalist or working with that The Conversation editor. And I found that to be a really useful thing. Again, it's easy to be linkable on social media and things like that. And on my recent hyper-realistic mask thing on that, I think there was about 60,000 views or 60,000 reads within the first week to 10 days of the wider population base beyond the specialists who would perhaps read the paper. So I would encourage PhD students, of whether they're working with industry or not, that if you have a paper that's coming out that might be of relevance to a wider audience, then very much look at The Conversation. I've had a very good experience with them. The next example of ways in which you can develop that sort of research and knowledge exchange portfolio is through live events. Now, one of the other regular events I've taken part in is Explorathon, European Researchers Night, which happens once a year at the end of September. So to give you an example, at the Glasgow Science Museum, we'll go and take examples of tasks, and we'll put posters on the walls, and we'll put some interactive displays, maybe take along the head-mounted eye tracker to get people involved in science and to get them to take part. And we sometimes have some short tasks that they might want to take part in as well. Of course, when you're doing these things, you have to, of course, make sure everything's been ethically approved and procedure-wise and everything else is up to date. But even if you're not looking to collect data, then one of the best ways that you can get your research out there is to go to these sort of public engagement events. It's really worthwhile doing them. And the good thing is that once you've done one, you've created the materials for one, you then have a box of materials sitting there for the next one. So then the British Science Association might come and say, would you like to come and do a stall or something like that. To give you a concrete example from my own time, I published a paper on super recognisers and a follow-up article in The Conversation, and the London Science Museum got in contact to say, would you like to do a Science Lates exhibition? And we went there and we did that, and we ran a study and got a publication out of it. So that's a great way of ensuring that you can get your research out there as well. And if people are interested in taking part in it and all of the ethical guidelines have been approved and so on, and it's appropriate, then it sometimes offers a data collection opportunity as well. I know that there are people who go to the London Science Museum or the Glasgow Science Museum with laptops and do that as well. So again, that's another way of engaging with the public. So those would be the main routes that I found particularly helpful. It would be press releases, but the caveats of doing them properly and getting support until you feel comfortable with the process. It would be The Conversation. And these live events, that once we go over this pandemic, that when these return, there are plenty of live events from the Cheltenham Science Festival, British Science Association, London Science Museum, all across the country. The Explorathon, there will be your local science museum that will be interested in perhaps having a night where you can showcase your research. And if you group together with other PhD students, that makes a full evening of it as well.
That sounds really interesting. In terms of percentage of time in a day or a year while you were working on your postdoc and really cool research in facial recognition, I presume that putting all that extra time into writing those articles, those press releases, setting up those public engagement projects, how much time did you put into that? Because it sounds like such a mammoth task on top of the already high work demands that I'm sure you had just fulfilling your academic role.
So I'll tell you something that might be unpopular, but it's true. I, as a lecturer now, I have much less time as a result of admin and marking and so on than I did as a PhD student. So I understand and I remember well how busy and how stressed I was as a PhD student. But you need to use that time wisely. Take it from somebody who's been through it, that during your PhD, you shouldn't see the writing of a press release or the writing of an article for The Conversation or a public engagement event as an unnecessary extra resource that you just have to devote time to. It's now a central core element of what you should be doing. It really is. And remember that, you know, when you come to finish your PhD and you're looking for postdocs and work, the more that you can add to your CV and the more added value that you could give to a postdoctoral position, the better position you will be in the job market. So what I would say is I fully understand the question and, you know, I completely get where you come from. I've been there myself. But It's more difficult now to do these things because of the other responsibilities that I have. But as a PhD student, you have a wonderful time in your career. You might not seem like it at the time, but you have a wonderful period of your career in 3 or 4 years to focus solely on research and dissemination. You will obviously have to do some personal development classes and, I don't know, some programming classes or whatever. But these things that I've mentioned should be seen as added value. And also, it's a reward for the hard work that you've done, because, as I said, you talked about getting your papers out. Well, you know, you got them out, so now shout about them. You know, so academia can sometimes feel like a stressful slog, but one of the most rewarding parts is you've got your paper published. You then disseminate it. You get feedback on it. It can be positive or it can be constructive, but either way, it feels as though you've made a contribution. So I think that's how I'd answer that. Yeah.
I think that's something I definitely struggle with, actually, because academia is a very individual thing. So you're working on your own quite a lot, especially when you're writing papers. And so once you've finished it, for me, it does then seem strange to want to present that to a lot of people. But having the confidence to do that is definitely important. I wanted to ask as well, you said that this was important to include in your PhD. Once you moved to your postdoc role, were these things now incorporated into your role, or did you still find you were taking extra time to do those things?
They were incorporated into my role. So as part of the, I was leading the applied strand of Mike's grant at that point, and in the postdoc, and that was very much part of my responsibilities, was to ensure that we engaged with facial recognition specialists and experts in society. So that was very much part of the role, yeah.
Now we would like to ask you about your plans for the future. I guess it's always hard to look into the future, but what are your career goals and where would you like to go from here, given this academic and applied experience that you have?
I now work at the University of Strathclyde School of Psychological Sciences and Health, and I'm trying to establish my own lab at the moment, the Applied Cognitive Psychology Lab. And that involves applying for independent research grants and external funding in order to fund a line of research projects. But at this moment in time, I see my chosen career as academia. I'm very fortunate that I work with a fantastic bunch of people at Strathclyde, all super supportive and all very much care about research, but also ensuring a good student experience as well. The next sort of set of goals for me would just be to continue to try and establish my research lab and to try and get in some externally funded grants to try and allow a line of research to be undertaken in depth.
I wondered if you had any advice or ways you would imagine universities evolving to allow for these applied roles to become more commonplace. Is it implementing this while people are doing the PhDs? Is it making more postdoc roles that allow the work with the industry? How do you see this evolving, if you do at all?
I think part of it, Katie, is a natural evolution because it's natural, I think, or it's getting more natural that scientists and practitioners are gravitating towards each other in order for mutually beneficial research and objectives to be met. So maybe previously industry organisations would have and still do their own research and development teams. But I think that there is much more of a focus now on industry-university partnerships, which ensures you get the best of both worlds. You get the operational aspects from the industry, but then you get the standard scientific research framework from these institutions. So I think it's naturally evolving and it's getting better all the time. And I think certainly, I can't speak for all universities, but I think there's a focus on across academia for a greater level of partnership with industry and organisations when undertaking a serious bit of research.
Do you have any advice for current students who think their research could be applicable to industry and how they would go about forming those future partnerships? I guess we've covered going to conferences and making sure you disseminate your work, but are there any other bits of advice that you would give?
I think that, again, just to cover what I said before, it's about having the confidence and the proactive nature. You know, your PhD doesn't start or stop when you're in the testing room or running an online Qualtrics task. It's much, much more than that these days. You know, you have to devote time not just to the doing of the research and the writing of the thesis and so on and trying to get papers out to enhance your CV, but you should now see this wider dissemination of your work and engagement with industry or society stakeholders, if they're relevant, as a core part of what you're doing. So that's just what I would just reiterate what I outlined before. But as I say, that should be from the outset, but it's also just having a bit of that confidence to say, look, In order to do this and to do it well, I need to get out there and to at least network with industry to see if there is a niche or a route for what it is that I'm doing with the industry partners, if they're not already part of the funding process and so on. So start these processes early in your PhD. I'm talking the first year in your PhD. I know a lot of people are maybe just reading or fermenting research questions. But as part of your personal and professional development and your transferable skills for later in the job market, year one, you should be thinking, okay, if my research has an applied or an industry slant, how can I disseminate my work to those industries? How can I work with them? How can we get added value from the work that we're doing in the lab?
That was really, really interesting from a personal point of view for both of us, as well as for our listeners. So thank you so much, David. It was great to chat.
Thank you, Katie and Carolyn. And to reiterate that it's great work that you're doing, and just I wish you all the best. And if anyone is listening, I wish you all the best in your PhD too.